Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we meet Olivia Glenn, newly named a deputy commissioner at New Jersey's Department of Environmental Protection. We'll discuss the growing environmental justice movement and how new legislation could improve the future of impoverished communities. Also, Mighty Writers creator Tim Whitaker talks about mighty songwriters and the performers who are teaching young people about what it takes to write lyrics. But first, mail-in voting will play an unprecedented role in this year's presidential election. But questions continue to swirl around the process, and many voters are seeking answers. The U.S. Postal Service has been hard-pressed to deliver on time recently, hamstrung by policy changes and enormous debt. President Trump has been claiming, without evidence, that vote-by-mail will lead to massive fraud, and the vote-by-mail procedure itself can involve time and a bit of patience. Philly Penn political editor Max Maron wrote about this recently for WHYY, and he joins us now with a primer. Hi, Max.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So, as you write, this is Pennsylvania's first year with widespread mail-in voting. The primary a couple months ago, Max, was an initial test of this election system. Remind us of how mail-in voting went in the primary, and were there any changes made to the process for the general election?
Right. It was Pennsylvania's first venture with mail-in voting. And during a pandemic, as you can expect, everything was, a little bumpy to get off the ground. There were some issues. And, frankly, nobody knew how it was going to go. All things considered, there was no evidence of election fraud with the mail-in ballots that were cast. More than half of Pennsylvania's eligible voters ended up voting by mail in the primary. So it gives you an indication of how popular it was. And moving forward ahead of this election, there are a number of changes that election officials are trying to seek amid great resistance from Washington to make it easier for voters to keep casting those ballots by mail.
What sorts of changes? Do you have that information offhand?
Sure. Yeah. Philadelphia and other counties are trying to set up right now satellite offices where voters could actually physically go in and get and apply for and complete the mail-in ballot on the spot. There's some funding issues there, but they're trying to overcome those hurdles against the deadline. There are more drop-off locations this time for your mail-in ballot to allow people the kind of ease of confidence ahead of all the issues that we're facing with the USPS to deliver those ballots and trust that they're going to get into the hands of election officials safely.
Okay, Max, let's get to the nuts and bolts. If a person wants to vote by mail, they must apply for a ballot, at least in Pennsylvania. Who is eligible to apply and what do they need to do to complete the process?
Any registered voter in Pennsylvania can apply for a mail-in ballot. It's that simple. All you got to do is register to vote, and there's still time to do that. The deadline for voting in the upcoming general election is October 19th. So as long as you apply and get approved to become a registered voter by then, you can apply for a ballot, and you have some wiggle room in there to do so. All you need is a driver's license or a state ID card. You can apply for the ballot online. If you don't have access to the internet, you can print out the form and hand it in directly to election officials or a trusted elected official to make sure that gets dropped off.
Okay, and you mentioned the registration deadline. There are a couple of other important deadlines to keep in mind if you are voting by mail in Pennsylvania. What are they?
Right. There are two big deadlines here to keep in mind, and the one is that you have until 5 p.m. on October 27th to get your application to your county election office, whether that's Philadelphia, Montgomery County. You just have to get it to that office by 5 p.m., hand-delivered or by mail. And then there is the second deadline, which is equally important, which is to submit the actual ballot itself. Once you have applied for the ballot, gotten approved, and usually there's no resistance in terms of getting approved as long as, you reside in the state and there are no issues with your voter eligibility. You fill out that ballot and make sure you get it back by 8 p.m. on election night. That does not mean right now there's some confusion over postmarking on election day. Last week, Pennsylvania election officials were asking to extend the deadline for ballots that are mailed in on election day to give them a few extra days wiggle room, considering the delays that we're seeing with the Postal Service. But as it stands right now, plan ahead. If you want to get that ballot in, you make sure you don't wait until election day to get it in. You're going to mail it far in advance is what the general recommendation is.
Okay. Are there applications available in languages other than English?
Right now on the Pennsylvania Department of State's website, you can get the application in English and Spanish only. We're looking into seeing if there's going to be any other translation services available. I think there's some community groups for various, you know, immigrant and, you know, ESL communities in Philadelphia that are also available to help out people who want to apply. They're going to have some language barrier problems.
Okay. What if you receive an application in the mail from an advocacy group? Is this sort of application legit?
There are some advocacy groups, nonpartisan, that are just trying to encourage mail-in voting by sending out ballots to voters in Pennsylvania and other states. You know, in some states, the election officials are sending out ballots to the voters directly. In Pennsylvania, we're not having that. You have to apply, make sure that you get it yourself. There are groups that are trying to make sure you get that application so that you do apply. The general recommendation is to not accept any application from anybody but a trusted authority. So your county election officials, that's where you want to get the application from. The Pennsylvania Department of State, which handles the elections, that's where, you know, you want to make sure you're just following the rules, considering the kind of deep anxieties around this election right now. Make sure you're getting the right application.
Better safe than sorry, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a good time to know, too, that in New Jersey will send mail-in ballots to all registered voters for the November election. And in Delaware, applications for mail-in ballots will be sent to all registered voters. So for those of us who live outside the Pennsylvania area, you know, it's a good idea to check your government website for the complete description of what you need to do. There was, Max, a hard lesson learned during the primary this past June. A lot of ballots did arrive after the hard deadline. I think it was tens of thousands, right?
Yes, absolutely. And this is kind of one of the most heartbreaking things for advocates of democracy and people who are trying to improve the mail-in process ahead of the general election, where we're going to see millions of more voters than came out in the primary. Now, in that primary, Pennsylvania, or Philadelphia alone, I think, had nearly 15,000 ballots arrived after the deadline, which means they just weren't getting counted. These people wanted to vote. They sent them in, but they missed the cutoff time. You know, Montgomery County had nearly 6,000. You know, Delaware County had 2,500. These are huge numbers. These are, you know, significant in a crucial swing state like Pennsylvania. And the moral of this story, which, you know, both elected officials not on both sides of the aisle are advocating for people to get the ballots in early, especially considering the delays we're seeing with the mail service. There is no such thing as too early to apply for that application and to send in your ballot to ensure that it gets there.
So if a person I'm sorry for jumping in, but if a person wanted to apply and then get the ballot in, I mean, how early is too early? Or you said there's no such thing as too early?
Right. Get online today if you can, and just make sure you have that application out. You'll most likely be approved if you meet the base criteria for applying, and then you'll get your ballot as soon as possible, and then you can get it back in. And there's a number of ways, you know, even if you're having some deeper concerns about putting that thing in postmarking, you know, having it put in a mailbox and trusting that it'll arrive to the election office, there's a number of ways that you can get it there even sooner if you'd like.
Yeah, and you'd mentioned earlier drop boxes. Tell us, Max, who empties the drop boxes? They're not mail personnel, correct?
Correct.
Were they found to be safe during the primary?
Correct. There were no concerns with these boxes during the primary, aside from the Trump campaign, which did file a lawsuit against Pennsylvania over its election practices, particularly citing these mail-in drop boxes. Now, these are run by the county election officials in Philadelphia. That's the Philadelphia City Commissioners. They are personally sending their people to these boxes to collect the ballots and bring them securely back to the tabulation center that they have on Spring Garden Street near the Delaware. These are not being sent through the mail. You're not going to have to deal with the issues of the sorting process. These are being collected directly. There's a number of locations that you can find online for where they are all over the city, and check with your county election officials in the suburbs if that's where you are.
Okay, we've got a comment from Trish, who says, I'm concerned about what the administration is doing with the Postal Service. We need mail-in voting because the Russians can't hack the mail. So probably, the driving force behind why mail-in voting is being made available and why it is being, the processes are in place to make sure it's more secure and more available to an increasing number of voters. Max, if you vote by mail, is there any way to know for sure that your vote has been counted?
Right. You can provide your email address on your application and be in direct connection with the Pennsylvania Department of State, which is administering all of this county level election resources at the state level. And you'll be able to check and track the progress of your ballot as it goes in. As long as you have access to the internet, you can plug in. You don't even need your code. You should just be able to put in some of the basic personal information about yourself, and the state will provide you securely with a ballot tracker that'll let you know if it's been received, if it's pending, if it's still out. If you don't have access to the internet, you can always call. There's a number as well, 1-877-VOTES-PA. And you can also, you know, send an email to your local election officials. And keep in mind, whoever your trusted elected official is, or, you know, government bureaucracy in your area, they are there to help you kind of answer these questions as well and make sure that, you know, understanding that there's a lot of confusion about this ahead of the election. So there's plenty of ways to track the ballot. And there are, you know, some concerns right now of how do you know if your ballot application is coming to you. This, you know, there's, as long as you're seeing, if you go on that website and you see a pending status, mm-hmm. and that's what it says, you'll know that your ballot is on the way. A lot of people signed up for the primary election, and they are still, you know, on a rolling basis going to have their application sent to them automatically.
There was some confusion about the word pending. Thank you so much for clearing mm-hmm. that up. And if by chance there is no confirmation that your vote has been counted, where can a constituent turn? To whom can a constituent turn?
You go to the Philadelphia City Commissioners. Again, there are local election officials. They're going to be the direct source and the ones that are going to be tabulating your votes here in Philadelphia County. If there are concerns that you have about getting that ballot in, a lot of people, life is too hectic right now, especially considering everything else going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you might be rushed up against the deadline and you're concerned about, you know, you haven't put your mail-in ballot in the mail and election day is right around the corner, or it is election day. There's also a new option this year where you can, in Philadelphia County, take your mail-in ballot to the polling site and have them basically surrender that ballot, and then you can vote in person if you're just too concerned about, you know, maybe your vote not getting counted at the last minute. So you can just even take that ballot right in, say, hey, I don't want to vote by mail, I just want to vote in person. They'll say, no problem, we'll just tear this up, and then you can cast your ballot in person.
Okay, question from Marisol. My daughter and I registered online for the mail-in ballot and online received emails that we were approved. A few days later in the USPS mail, we received official forms for applying for a mail-in ballot with our names already printed in the appropriate slots. Is this just a coincidence? Do we need to fill this out too? Do you have that information at hand, Max?
I would make a phone call directly to, I'm assuming those came from the Department of State. If they didn't come from the Department of State, that's concerning. But yeah, I would make a phone call and just ask them to clarify why you're receiving that in the mail. Again, if you apply online, there should be no additional process that you have to fill out in order to just make sure that your ballot will get sent to your house. You should be able to do that entirely online.
Okay. And very quickly, Max, polling places, traditional polling places will be open. Ned wants to know why more can't be open in problem areas where lines can be somewhat long. And I'm guessing the answer to that is probably, you know, because of the pandemic.
The pandemic, it's a huge issue. We saw major reductions in the number of polling places, which, you know, as we know, living in the city, it make it very convenient that you can just go within a couple blocks of your house to your polling place. During the primary, considering the staffing shortages and the health risks, the number of places were slashed dramatically.
Okay.
And we don't have the full list of how many polling places there will be.
Got to stop you there. We'll stay tuned and we'll report that information when we get it. Max Maron, thank you so much. Welcome back to the Regional Roundup.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Barry Cummings, Jordan. A person's zip code can make all the difference in the world when it comes to the quality of the air they breathe and the effect on health. According to a state report a few years back, those who live in Camden were much more likely to head to the emergency room because of asthma than people who live in many other parts of the state. Moderate to severe asthma has been linked to air pollution in Camden. A highly impoverished city is also highly industrialized. Environmental justice advocates in New Jersey are now hoping the future of public health in communities like Camden and Newark, New Jersey, is brighter. legislation that would require the State Department of Environmental Protection to take overburdened communities into consideration before issuing permits for new industrial projects could be close to final approval. We're taking calls and comments at 888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Olivia Glenn is a newly appointed deputy commissioner at the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection, and she joins us now to weigh in on this and other pressing issues of environmental justice in the state of New Jersey. Olivia Glenn, welcome to the Roundup.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's get a broad look to start at what communities in cities like Camden and Newark have to contend with. You grew up in Camden. Olivia, tell us about life lived near or in a highly industrialized area.
Yes, I can certainly tell you some about my own life. I am a Camden native who has long been shaped by the power and potential of landscapes. And my threshold into the world of environmental management was from observing the dichotomies between the idyllic viewsheds of New Hampshire and Vermont in college in comparison to the open space desert of my native Camden. I grew up in a really safe and loving community in a home with my parents, both of whom are retired public servants. And I was in a nice neighborhood within the city with the highest home ownership and the highest socioeconomic status. But it still had environmental disparities. There were four trees on the street that I grew up on. We recreated on the sidewalks and in the street. It was a great childhood, but we couldn't safely walk to or play in parks. And a lot of us had asthma. So I juxtapose that in comparison with what it was like being in rural New England, just how beautiful it was with the Green Mountains of Vermont, the calm of the Connecticut River, and the majesty of the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and my lack of asthma and allergies during my time there. And that's largely just a juxtaposition of the two different experiences. And I just wanted to work to forge a way to bring some of that beauty from that landscape to people who live in urban centers.
Yeah. So you're saying, I mean, your experience during college and et cetera brought you to the Northeast, New Hampshire, and et cetera. You know, sometimes the aromas of summer can just be absolutely wonderful, the scent of flowers on a walk, freshly cut grass, that sort of thing. Is this something that, you know, an overburdened community, the small things, experiences with any regularity?
Right. You can experience some of that beauty when people establish urban gardens and people take care of their own yards, but that is often juxtaposed by power plants that might be nearby. In Camden, for example, they have a lot of areas that have concentrations of industry, and this industry is adjacent to communities. So you'll smell what's coming from the regional sewage treatment plant, or you'll smell from the energy recovery facility or the metal recycling yard. And these things, with their cumulative impact, decrease the quality of life for people who live in overburdened communities.
And you mentioned asthma. What is the, for those of us who do not have to deal with asthma, what is that experience like? You know, on a moderate to severe level, what was it like for you and people whom you knew growing up in Camden?
Right. I know for me that my asthma was rooted in allergies. So it would start off with a trigger with something environmental like dust or sometimes too much pollen. And so it begins with that, but then it begins to overtake your lungs where you're not able to breathe. And you get treatments that you can take that sometimes work, and they work pretty quickly. But if they don't work pretty quickly, you end up in the emergency room where you're getting steroid treatments in very strong doses of just medicine to help open up your lungs and to ease your breathing.
And asthma, again, is often linked to air pollution, which disproportionately can affect poor communities of color?
Yes, that's correct. Certainly, we see that data in New Jersey and other places around the country.
So we're talking about, we're using a term, overburdened communities. Could you give us a general definition of what an overburdened community is, Olivia?
Yes. An overburdened community is one where there's a large population of people who are poor and or people of color, and or they have limited English proficiency. And so you have these underlying social factors And when you look at some of the environmental stressors that come on top of it, it just creates a situation that someone doesn't have an easy way to get out of because they don't have the resources or connection to be able to propel themselves out of it. So some of those environmental stressors are caused by air quality. So it can be facilities like power plants, but it can also be if someone lives too close to a highway. Actually, the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state of New Jersey are mobile sources. So that comes from cars, trucks, vehicles that are adding to air pollution. So you have a lot of communities that are really close to highways that experience those burdens from the air.
Yeah.
When it comes to the...
No, go right ahead.
Okay, great. when it comes to water, it also is looking at the infrastructure that provides drinking water to homes. So it can be the age of the pipes and the quality of the water that's coming into those pipes. So we saw some of that when we saw what was happening in Flint, Michigan a couple months ago, and then some of the work where we were really successful in Newark in helping with their water quality issues. And we need to do more of that all around our state and the country to help communities that have combined sewer overflows to really just update those systems so that the water infrastructure that's providing water into homes is safe. And just lastly, it's looking at land use. So you have brownfields, which are those old abandoned industrial sites that have not been cleaned up that need to be brought back online to be community amenities. There are more brownfield sites and contaminated sites in these communities. And what we see coupled with that is a lack of environmental benefits. So environmental benefits is about the quality and quantity of open spaces. So just like my own experience, there was a park nearby, but I didn't have the ability to enjoy that park safely or safe corridors to get there. I would have had to walk through an alleyway or up a really busy street to be able to access what was my community park. So we're trying to address environmental burdens as well as improve environmental benefits for people who live in these communities.
Okay, let me
overburdened.
Let me reintroduce you. Olivia Glenna is Deputy Commissioner for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. The Murphy administration right now is focusing environmental justice efforts in what are described as overburdened communities. Olivia, let's take a look at some legislation that is pretty exciting to environmental justice advocates. It would require the DEP to take a close look at how projects like the big manufacturing plant or the new incinerator might impact the environment and health of these communities before any state permits are issued. So if enacted, how might this affect the future of, say, a family in Camden or Newark? Newark has the Covanta incinerator, the Newark International Airport, the northern branch of the Turnpike, addressing some of these issues that you were referring to earlier.
Yes, it will give us the opportunity to take a look at what some of the environmental stressors are in that community, as well as the proximity of where people live to where these facilities are sited, and facilitate fair treatment and meaningful involvement for the members of the community who want to have a voice in the process. So we're hoping that if the legislation passes, it's still in deliberation with our legislature. We do know that our governor has already publicly provided his support for it, and DEP is prepared at that time to enact regulations that support the public engagement and the cognizance of environmental stressors to make sure we're making the safest decisions for our residents, but also balancing that with economic development.
So when you say balancing that with economic development, where does that fit into the picture?
Right. So we know that it's always a balance between supporting our communities and providing places for people to have jobs and providing amenities. But we don't believe that the two are mutually exclusive. We believe that the two can be done. We just have to do it with smart, coordinated planning.
So how, unfortunately, many of these communities, these overburdened communities have been, I don't want to use the word targeted, but really the place that these new entities might focus on coming in. It's a lot harder to, say, build a new waste incinerator in a wealthier community. How does the state manage to provide balance here if a new entity wants to come in and maybe, we're done with Newark, we're done with Camden because it will just tax these communities and lobby to get these things built elsewhere?
Right. So some of those finer points are being worked out through the course of the legislation at this point in time, and we'll iron out some of those finer points when we structure the regulations. But I do want to say that for environmental justice communities, it's not that they don't want any development there. They just don't want the harmful developments to be really close to their communities. So we're going to work to be sure that we're bringing economic development opportunities into communities that bring positive benefit, because it's not just we just want to keep the bad things up, but we also want to bring in the good opportunities for people as well to have a thriving economic tax base.
Fair enough. So here's where the bill is, as I understand it. It's passed the state Senate. The assembly held off in July after some intense lobbying by industry and labor. And apparently now an assembly vote is set for later this month. Some version of this measure, Olivia Glenn, has been around at least a decade. Are you optimistic that now might be the moment for passage?
I am cautiously optimistic, and I believe that things are coming together. So we're going to wait and see what the legislature does in a few weeks.
Why do you think you are? Why are you cautiously optimistic that after a decade this might pass?
I think that the point of time that we're in right now, with the state of emergency, with COVID, and how it has just triggered a whole domino effect in all of our personal and professional lives, it's caused us all to do a little bit of reflection. And when we look at how this pandemic has rolled out, it's not simply about it being a public health emergency, but it's also the disparities that it has illuminated. So I think with some of that, it's really an opportune time. We've seen that disparity in the public health data that's been coming out about people who are getting COVID, but also the recovery effort, and then people who are passing away from it. And we see the disparities in that. And it's in full play for all of us to see. And I think that the same thing is happening right now with environmental justice as a priority, where we can see how timely and how important it is and how we have to do the most to protect our communities that are overburdened. So I feel like when we're all in this space right now, in this state of emergency, it's triggering us to be more sensitive and more empathetic to communities that are facing these kinds of challenges. So I think with all of that, I think that should all come into play as the legislature takes a look at this piece of legislation.
Olivia, how do we reduce pollution from entities already in place, like the Covanta waste incinerators in both Camden and Newark? Covanta says it is committed to installing state-of-the-art emissions controls. But is this also an environmental justice priority?
It is also an environmental justice priority for us to work with all of our regulated community to help minimize impacts to overburdened communities.
As I understand it, one of your responsibilities as deputy commissioner will be to implement something called Executive Order 23. What is Order 23? Describe that for us.
Yes, it's an executive order that the governor passed to address environmental justice. And it directed us as the Department of Environmental Protection to create a guidance document to lay out the path for all state departments, agencies, boards, councils, and commissions in considering environmental justice in all of their decision making. So what we're doing through that is we're laying out a process by which other state departments and agencies can look at their practices and procedures to make sure that what they're doing in their decision making is involving communities who are impacted by their decisions, when it could be an environmental deficit, but also making sure that we're providing benefits to people in overburdened communities at a rate that they should receive them. Also, as a last tier of that, it's also helping to be strategic in terms of building capacity in overburdened communities. So with this multi-tiered strategy, what we're looking to do is to collectively kind of synergistically advance the efforts that happen across state government. The things that happen in terms of environmental justice are not solely in the hands of the Department of Environmental Protection, mm-hmm. but we also have to work with community affairs, transportation, the Department of Health, agriculture, and others to make sure we're all working together with the same goal in mind. So this executive order is coordinating all of us to work on one accord.
Sounds like a tall order. It's trying to determine which initiatives might work for various departments and then getting the departments on board. I mean, Olivia, state government can seem like a labyrinth of rules and regulations and policy.
It sure can. And one of the things that we're going to do in implementing this order is establishing an interagency council that will have representatives across all of state government to help advance some of these efforts.
A lot of this work, I'm guessing, costs money. And I think we ask this question every week of at least one guest. But, you know, the coronavirus has battered budgets, both local and state. Do you feel, Olivia Glenn, you'll be able to get fully to work on these initiatives with the resources you have now?
I certainly think that there is low-hanging fruit with the resources that we already have. And when we come together to work in a coordinated fashion, that whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts. So we're able to do more alignment of how we're making our funding decisions across departments. It should help, certainly help leverage us all. And I do have to say, we're also doing a lot of coordination with the nonprofit community, as well as philanthropic organizations, to give that support to community-based groups. So I think with all of us going in the same direction, working in a coordinated fashion, we can certainly seize the moment.
So when you speak of low-hanging fruit, are there any environmental justice projects you would like to see get underway immediately?
Yes, I have a few that are already underway from a natural resource perspective. One of the really big projects we're working on is the transformation of the Harrison Avenue landfill in the city of Camden to convert it to a waterfront park. The facility operated as a landfill for decades, and what we're doing is doing a full closure of that landfill, building a park on it, and when it's done, it will be a 62-acre park, and it will become the largest park in the city of Camden. And we anticipate a fall 2021 opening for that location.
All right. Go ahead.
So that's just one example of many things that we hope to get underway in the next 18 months.
All right, Olivia Glenn, it was a pleasure to speak with you.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Olivia Glenn is Deputy Commissioner for the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Up next on the Regional Roundup, we have a conversation with Tim Whitaker. He is the founder of the Mighty Writers Program, which has recently launched a music performance series featuring some high-profile musicians who submit their stories and performances to encourage kids to write lyrics. It's called Mighty Songwriters. And we'll be talking about that in just a few minutes on the Regional Roundup. Stay with us. You are listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Gordon, the coronavirus put a halt to many activities this year, but it cannot stop the power of the pen, as evidenced by the work of Mighty Writers, an educational nonprofit whose mission is to teach children to think clearly and write with clarity. When Mighty Writers' brick and mortar centers across the Delaware Valley shut down, operations transitioned online, reaching hundreds of its young members who are still writing. Now the group has added a fun twist called Mighty Songwriters, a video series which has drawn in some big-name songwriters and musicians to perform and talk about their experiences with writing. We're taking calls and comments, 888-477-9499. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. For the rest of the hour, we're speaking with Mighty Writers founder and executive director, Tim Whitaker. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Mary. Thank you for having me.
Of course. We'll get to the songwriters in just a moment, but first let's set the table, if you will, and just talk briefly about children and writing during the pandemic. Many kids who had to turn to online school this spring are now heading into the fall with significant learning deficits, with more online learning ahead. So how critical is the maintenance of writing skills, and what might be the consequence of losing those skills, Tim?
Well, you know, I think that writing has been a challenge for kids even before the pandemic. I don't think writing has had the same place in schools that math and science and standardized testing has. So, you know, we've always been very ambitious and aggressive about pushing writing for kids, because we believe that to write with clarity, you have to think clearly first. And if you think clearly and you write with clarity, good things are going to happen. Success is going to come into view. And so that's always been our mission. Clearly, it's much more challenging now being online. We have all our writing workshops that we had in person now up in line, more than 20 of them at the moment. Everything from girl power workshops to mindfulness to college to protest songwriting. And we have a lot of bilingual workshops because we serve a lot of kids in the Mexican community. So, you know, we work really hard to keep it exciting for them, to bring the joy, and to get them to think clearly through this pandemic, which is difficult for grown-ups, let alone kids.
Yeah, it is. How did Mighty Songwriting come about?
Mighty Songwriting came about because of one of our board members, Joe McEwen, who works for, is an executive at Concord Music. And he had the idea of getting musicians to come on and not just sing a few songs, but talk about writing, talk about what turned them on, maybe a teacher, maybe a book they read. So it's a mix of a couple of songs and some really entertaining talk about what writing means to these performers. And, you know, we've been really amazed by Jewel, for example, who, you know, is very candid and moving about growing up with dyslexia and being homeless for a time. Marcus Roberts is a great jazz pianist who was blind, talked about learning to read and write by his mother, who was also blind. So, you know, a lot of unexpected conversation, and great for kids to hear, great for grown-ups to hear.
Okay, so speaking of Jewel and Marcus Roberts, we've got some clips lined up of what they bring to Mighty Songwriters. Let's get to Marcus Roberts first.
Okay.
I lost my sight when I was 5 and a half years old. So when I went to the first grade, at first I really couldn't read or write. My mother, who also is totally blind, she didn't really get a chance to learn how to read and write when she went to school. So she was definitely going to make sure that I was able to read and write. You probably can see this machine that I have that I'm using to read right now. So I'm reading Braille, which is a different way of expressing yourself in the English language, using different Braille characters that represent the letters and the numbers and punctuation that we use when we write. So that was a very, very, very important thing for me, and I've always enjoyed reading and writing. It just opens up a whole new world of ideas that you can explore.
So, Tim, Marcus talks about his mom's influence. I guess we just can't underestimate the power of a loved one to influence a child's life.
Yeah, it's interesting because I always talk to the kids and even our volunteers who are all interested in writing and have writing in their career in one facet or another. And when I ask them what turned them on to writing, it's invariably a parent and often the mother who they'll tell me that, you know, the mother always made them revise letters or stories that they're writing for school and just got them excited about writing.
How can parents and family members nurture a child's writing, even if they might not have the skills themselves?
Well, I think having books around the house, the one thing we do is we distribute a whole lot of books to our communities. Along with, since the virus, we also distribute diapers and food and all kinds of other necessities, boxes of groceries and meals and mindfulness activity books and all kinds of things. But we, first and foremost, we always, wherever we are, we distribute books. And I think just having books in the house is one thing that leads to an interest in writing and reading.
Okay, let's get to a singer-songwriter, Jewel, who talks about her dyslexia in her submission to the Mighty Songwriter series.
I never thought I'd become a writer. It's kind of funny that I'm a writer for a living. At a really difficult time learning to read when I was young. I was undiagnosed with dyslexia. But I ended up being really inspired in eighth grade because there was a philosophy program, and I loved the information so much that I ended up finally really just buckling down and trying to figure out how to get myself to read better. I ended up realizing I would take a white piece of paper and I would cut a little, I used an X-Acto knife and I cut a little teeny line out, just the width of a sentence. And I would lay that over a page in the book, and all I could see was one sentence at a time. And then I would just move it down, and that really helped clear up my vision because my eyes saw all the white on the page instead of the black. So if I saw a whole page of typed, you know, print, I just kept seeing all the white little squiggles, and my brain kept trying to make sense of those patterns, and it didn't try to make sense of the white typed patterns. I had to rewrite and paraphrase everything in my own language. You know, I'd write in the paragraphs every single sentence and then paraphrase what the paragraph's point was. It was very arduous. But again, I just loved what was in those philosophy books so much that it was really worthwhile. And it ended up being an incredible skill. It taught me to think. It taught me I was smart. But the teacher also saw that I was good at it, and he let me teach my own class of peers. I had my own eighth grade class, and I would lead their symposium. And then he let me teach high school teachers and how to teach teachers to teach their kids. So it ended up being an amazing experience, and I've really come to see my dyslexia as an advantage. I see things differently than other people.
Okay, let's talk about a couple points here, Tim. So Jewel talks about her dyslexia, and she comes up with a really creative way for her to work around her challenges. What does it mean to have an artist like Jewel open up about her experience?
I just think it's really cool to be that candid and that forthright about, you know, the challenges she faced as a kid. And I think that that's what this series is doing for me. That's what's so exciting to me about the series is to hear these artists talk about what turned them on and how they face these challenges, what writing means to them. You just don't get to hear musicians talk about that very often, if at all. So I think it's great for the kids. It's great for our volunteers and for the people that work at Mighty Writers to hear these stories.
Do you find dyslexia among your Mighty Writers? And if you do, how do you work with them?
Well, we have a program for that. We don't shout it to the rooftops too much. There are some families that would prefer to keep that under wraps a little bit. But we do address it directly.
And many of these artists talk about the teachers who've influenced and even changed their lives. What makes for good teaching, Tim Whitaker?
You know, I think, again, it gets back to our mission, which is to think clearly and write with clarity. And I think to be a good instructor of writing, you have to practice those two things yourself. You have to think clearly. And when you're showing kids how to write, you have to write very clearly yourself so they know what you want them to do. And, you know, when you're online like this, too, when you're in a virtual world with kids, you have to be a bit of a performer. You have to really be lean on charisma as best you can to keep the kids paying attention, to keep them alert so they don't get Zoom fatigue, which we all know about at this point.
I think it would could benefit all of us to learn to think more clearly, or many of us anyway. What does teaching this involve?
Teaching what? I'm sorry, Mary, what is that?
Teaching you know, kids and adults to learn to think more clearly.
How do you get them to do that?
How do you teach them? I'm interested, personally.
Well, I think it's, you know, I think it's just making an outline for yourself before you jump online to start teaching kids about writing. You know, what are the points you were trying to make? How do you intend to get there? Repetition, but not the exact same words, but hitting the same points again and again. You know, I think if you're thinking clearly, it sort of comes naturally to you, but it's something that you really have to sort of work at and foster with yourself and with people around you all the time.
Okay. Mighty Writers is a nonprofit. How has the pandemic impacted your bottom line?
Well, it's impacted us profoundly, actually, because when the virus hit in March, we could see that the communities that we serve, and we serve underserved communities, were in great need. So we immediately started distributing food and lunches to all of our five of our locations, actually. So we began with lunches, and then that grew into groceries, and then diapers, and then masks, and books. So now, you know, it's become a major part of what we do, a major part of our mission, and one that we will continue with as long as it's needed. So we do. That's at least half of our mission at this point. And the other half, of course, is the writing part of it.
Sure, but has it impacted the mission's bottom line?
No, the mission has stayed the same. Think clearly, write with clarity, and things, you know, you'll be able to get through the pandemic and you'll be able to get through anything that comes your way.
Okay. Are there any works, Tim Whitaker, from Mighty Writers Kids, which stand out for you over the years? And I think the organization's been around for what, a decade or so?
About 11 years. Yeah, there's been any number of stories that the kids have written that stay with me. Everything from one of our students who talked about living with depression, another one who talked about a parent who died, unfortunately, in Iraq. And so there's stories like that that have a profound impact. But there's also, you know, reading the kids talking about staying home through the pandemic and how challenging it is, and looking out for their siblings or younger siblings, you know, stories like that really, really sort of touch you, I think.
A love of literature and the ability to write can lead you where in life?
Well, it can lead you all kind of places. I think that, you know, you think about how many emails you receive over the course of a week that you have to read twice because they lack clarity. If you're able to write an email to apply for a job or to apply to high school you want to go to, or to write an essay to get into college, you know, writing just gets you so many places if you work at it and practice it and you can learn how to be clear about it.
How do you determine who you want to work with Mighty Songwriters, and what's the process like in securing these artists, Tim?
Well, we work with an outfit called Surefire Media, who works with a lot of musicians around the country. And so they send out an email to all their artists. They talk about what the program is. Are they interested in it? Are there people in their life who taught them how to write, who they can talk about? And then they filter through that.
Who's ahead in the lineup for the Mighty Songwriters coming up?
Well, I know there's Valerie June, who's a favorite of Michelle Obama, who loves electric blues and African rhythms, combines both of those in her work. A guy named Devin Gafilian, who grew up in Philadelphia, influenced greatly by the music his father listened to, and Gamble and Huff, of course, in Philadelphia. There are two I know of. I know there's some surprises I don't know about.
And there is a new artist introduced every week?
Is every that how Wednesday. Works? Every Wednesday, yep.
Okay. So, and one more quick question for you.
Sure.
Mighty Writers welcomes volunteers, I understand. What are you looking for in the person who'd like to jump in?
Well, we have a number of ways to volunteer. One is to be a one-on-one tutor for a student. That requires spending time every week with the student via Zoom now. So that's one way. The other is to be an assistant on any one of our workshops, of which we have anywhere from 20 to 30 posted at any given time. All the other information is on our website at mightywriters.org.
All right. Well, Tim Whitaker, it was great to talk to you. So nice to have you with us on Radio Times, or I should say the Regional Roundup.
Thanks, Mary. I appreciate it.
Tim Whitaker is founder and executive director of Mighty Writers. And we'll close now with jazz pianist Marcus Roberts playing his piece, Period of Denial. Don't forget, you can find us on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. John Ahrens is producer for the Regional Roundup, with help this week from Debbie Builder and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for tuning in, and be well.